This is a paper about Nietzsche's ethical views, basically, and it comes from it comes from a desire to present him in a way which is both sympathetic and true to his aims, as I understand them, but not being an apologist. I mean, if there's a problem, then I want to present the problem. And I'm doing that partly because I think there isn't enough of that about. And I'm doing it because it's the easiest way for me to engage with the philosophers to try and argue with them. And if effectively, the point of today's paper is to say, with respect to the late Nietzsche, his ethics, I'm talking about roughly 1886 onwards, I think I've got him. Right, that's what I'm trying to say. And I think I've got him on his own terms. Not. I mean, there are plenty of things to say from the outside about why there might be concerns about his philosophy, and some of them will doubtless occur to you as we progress. But the claim of the paper is, on his own terms, I think there's a major problem. And I'm going to try to spend my time showing you what I think that is and convincing you that it's the case. And I'm going to do it without very much exegesis, which is to say I'm not going to be spending a lot of time pointing into the passages. And the reason that I'm doing that is because I'm not going to assume a high level of familiarity with the texts. If I'm wrong about that when we get to the Q&A, or if some of you do want to talk about it, I'd be delighted to play ball, but in the presentation, it's really just the arguments and how I think they're going. So that's the overall idea. All right. Two background things before the two introductory things before where the handout starts. The first thing is that for those of you who don't know, can you hear me at the back? Am I audible? Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you. The first thing is. Nietzsche's writing in the context of a philosophical dispute which at the time had the status of a major public event, I mean a major public intellectual event, at least in German-speaking context, about which now one can assume zero knowledge, in some cases even among specialists. And that was what was called the pessimism strike, the dispute about pessimism, the pessimism dispute. And the pessimism dispute was kicked off more or less by Schopenhauer, though it really starts after Schopenhauer's death, so by Schopenhauerians. And the claim that they were taking up was Schopenhauer's lead that effectively, when it comes down to it, it's not worth being alive. If you want to put it in a slightly different way, slightly reformulated, but roughly similar, as a whole, is it a good thing that the universe happened? No. was the claim. What I want you to know about that is that to somebody writing when Nietzsche was, in the language that he was writing, in the community he was operating in, that was a live question. That was an intellectually respectable question. There were plenty of people who thought it wasn't an intellectually respectable question, but they had to argue for it. They didn't get it for free. They had to argue for it. And a lot of people seemed to be convinced that the answer was no. So that's the first thing that you have to bear in mind. And within the context of that dispute, Schopenhauer has various arguments. Most of them seem to revolve around the idea of suffering, that there's overwhelmingly more suffering than there is anything that could be the opposite of pleasure or value or anything like that. Overwhelmingly what you expect from life is suffering, structurally, and just overall, by any measure, it would be better if things hadn't happened like that. Now, there's various responses that people were trying out to that claim, or those set of claims that the pessimists. One option was to be an optimist, and there were people who were writing saying that actually the world was either as good as it could possibly be, or it was definitely very good, it was very good that it happened, it definitely had meaning. And there were various strategies for s- s- saying that, and I won't go into those, but there were some of those. The second thing you could do was say that the whole question was completely pointless and that there was no answer to it. That was a popular, for reasons, if you're familiar with Cantonism, that was, if you were, for neo-Cantonists, that was a good way of responding, because effectively, to argue that life was bad, they took you to be arguing that life had no overall purpose, and that was just something you weren't allowed to do on the Kantian story. You weren't allowed to say that there was a purpose to things, so that was that. And then there were various further views of Schopenhauer's views, various further pessimist views. One of the most famous figures at the time was someone called Hartmann, and Hartmann thought that we were heading towards the general realisation that life wasn't worth living, and that we would ultimately get together and make an agreement that we wouldn't procreate anymore, and thus the human race would die out. There's a small corner of the internet that still campaigns with this. I know that anything follows from there's a small corner of the internet that. But anyway, Hartmann and Meinander and some of these people still find support. Nietzsche's role in this, he wasn't a famous figure at the time, but his positioning of himself, this is the key point to go into this, I think combines elements of all three. So he does want to acknowledge that there are really very bad things. There is the pessimists kind of have a point, that there are terrible things to be reckoned with. The neo-Kantian position has something to it. There's something fishy about the whole question. He wants that too. And although the optimists are wrong to say that you can just point to the world and say how wonderful it is, he wants some kind of, well, affirmative story, or some kind of account of why it's good to be alive. So he wants that element of their story. And so those three kind of constraints are operating, I think, on what he's trying to do. So that part of the story, then, as I mentioned, the other part of the story is supposed to be internal question. That's the setup I want. Okay, so now starting on the handout. Here are two things that Nietzsche seems to want to claim, or rather, two things that I think you'd be hard pressed to find a Nietzsche scholar who doesn't think that Nietzsche thinks the following. Okay, first of all, that he's advocating affirmation, where in some sense affirmation means saying yes to or affirming sentence to life. Come to what that means at the moment. Second Nietzschean claim is that Christianity is anti-natural. By Christianity, those of you familiar with Nietzsche, it's broader than merely the religious views. It's also the moralities that he associates with or connects with Christianity. So all sorts of other secular views would be called Christian under this school. But effectively, they're anti-natural because they are telling you to do things they are telling you not to do things or forbidding you from doing things which it's natural for you to do. So anti-natural in that sense. You might be wondering what's on the list of things that are natural. I'll come to that in a minute. But in any case, you've got a set of things which it's natural for you to do, and Christianity comes along and says, don't do them. He's getting this straight from Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer's getting it straight from things like poverty, chastity, and obedience. Those are the three things that Schopenhauer would say. Those are all things that are natural, and Christianity tells you not to do them, which for Schopenhauer is good, and for Nietzsche is going to be bad. So those are two claims. And to which I wish to add, this is something that you won't find everybody saying, that the reason why he thinks that Christian moral thinking is life-negating, or is on the no-saying, or the non-affirming, or the negational side of things, just is that it's anti-natural. So it just is the fact that it tells you not to do things which it's natural for you to do. That's what it means for it to be life-negating. And we can see him relating these two ideas in what I'm terming his sort of central move for this paper, which I think is actually a central move for his later philosophy, and I've got that written down on the handout. So the first claim is that Christian morality claims that our natural instincts and activities are wrong and they are to be avoided. If you want to put it more simply, Christianity tells you don't do, and then there's some natural thing that it tells you not to do. And then the next move is that therefore Christian morality implies a judgment about life, and the judgment about life that it implies is that life as a whole is bad. So, because it tells you to do a series of things which are... So let's take Sand and Schopenhauer use often bisexuality. So Christian morality says, deny it, oppose it, negate it. You might think that it... Yeah, so you might think this is not true of Christianity. That's a separate thing. But Nietzsche's working in a tradition where people took this as plausible. But let's just suppose that's right. It tells you the natural instincts like sexuality are wrong, are bad, are to be feared, are to be avoided, are to be suppressed. Since those natural things are the sorts of things which produce and continue and further life, you can take it as implied that this is hostility to life. What they really don't like is life. It's not they don't like sexuality, but they really don't like life. And that's the thought behind it. So you can derive from a claim, don't do this natural thing, you can derive from that claim the implicit value judgment about life, that life is okay, is bad. Now, you might have all sorts of things to say about the soundness of that move. It seems to me at all levels that they're open to question. However, I'm not going into that now. What I want to talk about is why, if it works, it's important to him, or rather why it's important to him that it works. And the reason why is because Nietzsche wants to use it to object to people who don't explicitly say things like life as a whole is bad. So in Nietzsche's targets are not just people who are pessimists officially, i.e. people who say life as a whole is bad. It's not just the pessimist he's opposing. He's opposing lots of people who would say, if you ask them whether life as a whole is good, they would say, yes, it's fantastic. But he wants to say, actually, deep down, on some deep level, really what's going on is that they don't think that, and that they are hostile to life, and that they are really just pessimists who aren't acknowledging that they're pessimists. So they're anti-life, even if they don't think that they're anti-life. So that's why we need it. We need it to get people in our... So, you know, imagine a Christian who says, you know, life as a whole is wonderful, and it's wonderful, and as indeed many do. It's wonderful, and it's wonderful for these reasons, and it's definitely a good thing that there's life, and it's definitely a good thing that the universe was created as it was. Nietzsche wants to say, well, okay, but if you've got a morality which tells you to be hostile to things which are the conditions of continuation of life, you know, you can say all you like that life as a whole is wonderful, but it's clear from your morality that what's really going on is that you're hostile to it. And so that's why you need something like that. And once he's got that set up, so once he's got all the people he wants to get saying that it's implied that life as a whole is bad, Nietzsche's got two arguments against that, which he uses in a couple of different places, so they're regular things that show up. The first thing, these are my names for them, the first thing that he's going to talk about is something called what I'm calling a frame of reference argument. The frame of reference argument is you can't make the claim that life as a whole is bad because you have nothing to compare it to. So to say that something would be bad, you would need to have a conception of something that is better or worse. You need to have a comparative point, but you don't have one. All you've got is this one example. When you've got one example, you don't get to say whether it's... you have no distance, no context with which to make that judgment. That was a common enough, Nietzsche didn't invent that argument. Plenty of people use that against pessimism. But the new thing in Nietzsche is trying to derive the pessimist claim from all sorts of other people and then launch this against them for that reason. So that's the first thing. The second argument is weirder. And again, it requires a slight parenthesis in terms of the context, the intellectual context. Nietzsche is following Schopenhauer in thinking that you can profitably think about life as a kind of force which operates through people and enables them and, in fact, instructs them into valuing in certain ways. So life isn't just to be understood in a kind of neutral, descriptive way. Think about something like a life force. If you wanted a that I slightly hesitate to make this analogy, but anyway, it's not completely off the. It's merely an analogy, and that's not totally wrong. Something like the selfish gene would be not a million miles away from the sort of thing they're trying to make sense of at this time. I mean, a thing that operates through you, that has its own set of goals through you, which you don't necessarily, or wouldn't necessarily, if you were, as it were, completely independent of it, wouldn't necessarily sign up to, but it's going to kind of make you do them anyway, or at least it's going to encourage you strongly to do them anyway. So that's roughly how someone like Schopenhauer thinks about what he calls the will, but he also talks about life doing this. Life's going to make you do things. So in Schopenhauer, Schopenhauer thinks it's obviously not in your interest to have children. He thinks that any rational analysis of what it means to have children is going to immediately make it clear to you this is not something you ought to do. Just obviously not something you ought to do. However, you're all going to do it, and you're all going to do it because life has this separate thing in its own, and it's going to make you value it and choose it. So, if you've got a story like that, and a lot of people did, including I think Nietzsche by this point, then now look back at the people who are saying or making claims or acting as if or implying the claim that life as a whole is bad, right? If you've got a story where life operates through you to make value judgments on your behalf, and the value judgments that you produce are life as a whole is bad, what can you say about those people? Well, you can't say that they're wrong, but you can at least say they're weird, can't you? I mean, life is operating through them to make them say life is bad. Like, an analogy would be something like, the Foreign Office, it has the role of promoting British interests abroad. That's what it's for. The one thing we know about the Foreign Office is it promotes British interests abroad. Now, if all the Foreign Office spokesmen suddenly start showing up on your television screens saying, the one thing you've got to do is boycott and sanction Britain, and do everything you possibly can against Britain's interests. Well, you don't have the means to say that what they're saying is false. I mean, it might be that you should do that, and it might be that they think that it's in Britain's best interests to do that. I started using this analogy before you could actually say this was sort of what they were doing, by the way. I was coming kind of completely in the abstract. Just in the abstract, the thing that you would say would be either something's gone very wrong here, or this is part of some weird strategy. But it must be a very weird strategy that would produce a situation like this. That's what Nietzsche thinks is going on when it comes to something like pessimism. Like, you've got life operating through people in such a way that they start saying things like life as a whole is bad. You know, it doesn't mean they're wrong, it doesn't mean life as a whole is good, it just means be suspicious. Right? That's the... Okay, so you've got a story now on which you've got an account of what affirmation might look like for Nietzsche. And it's not just kind of saying yes to stuff. There's a force which operates through us, which is something like a life force or a life approach. Your affirmative when you do the things that life force or life thing, when you do the things that it wants you to do, that's affirming life. You are negating life when you oppose the things that it's telling you to do. So in Schopenhauer's example, which he's definitely borrowing from, you'd be life-affirming by having children because that's what life is operating for you to do, and you'd be life-negating if you did not have children because you would be not doing the thing that life wanted you to do. And for Schopenhauer, that's good not to do what life wants you to do, and for Nietzsche, he's going to be encouraging affirmation for reasons we're still coming to. So you've got an account of what that is, and now you might say, well, what counts as natural? Well, you know, if you look at the texts, he's following Schopenhauer in thinking that self-preservation is natural, or at least self-preservation, unless it's a question of species preservation. So, you know, you might sacrifice yourself for your offspring, but you wouldn't sacrifice yourself for an unrelated other person in Schopenhauer, Nietzsche. Selfishness, sex and procreation. There's also other local Nietzsche things that he's adding for various contextual reasons. Some of the famous things, including, you know, power-seeking. Nietzsche has an account of to be alive is to be power-seeking, whatever that means. So if you're anti that, then you're being anti-natural. He thinks that something like exploitation is natural. He thinks that error, making mistakes of a certain kind, is natural. The exact list isn't focused, though. We're happy to discuss it further. And going along with those things is affirmation, and opposing them is negation. If that's what it is. All right. Now, section 4, which discusses total affirmation and suffering, is kind of a subplot in this story. And I'm going to race through it relatively quickly for time. So sections 4 and 6 are supplementary stories involving quite a lot of dog whistling and Nietzsche scholars. So I don't think there's much point going into that. But I will just say this. Natural affirmation is not the only kind of thing that Nietzsche means when he talks about affirmation. And so if you're thinking of other famous cases which don't seem to fit with this, that's absolutely true. The most famous way in which he talks about affirmation would be things like the eternal recurrence, where what looks like is you're supposed to affirm down to the very last details all elements of your life repeatedly again and again. There are various problems with that, and what I would argue in a longer talk would be that thinking about him as he's got a link in mind between natural affirmation and total affirmation, which helps to explain some of the odd things that there are about total affirmation. Very roughly, it's as follows. If you think that there's this kind of life force which operates through all things and roughly determines how the whole arc of life continues, which is what Schopenhauer thought and what he seems to think, if you think that's going on, then affirming natural things just means affirming the whole lot. There isn't this separation between the two. So total affirmation can be achieved. Affirming absolutely everything that's ever been, ever will be, can be achieved kind of indirectly via affirming the motor behind it. Some story like that is going on. And there's more to say about that, so we can come back to it. But I want to make sure I get the major stuff in first. So, the situation that I set up, the natural affirmation story, has, I think, by his standards, once we've got that pinned down, two pretty major problems. And I think by going through those, you can begin to see why he ends up saying some of the controversial, peculiar things that he ends up saying. So, first major problem is this. We've got a setup where natural affirmation is doing what the natural or the life force is working through you to achieve. So, by the modern analogy, it would be affirmation of nature to do. Hi, Tim.
Oh, welcome. Hey, Tom.
It would be natural to do the sorts of things that, on the analogy that the selfish genes make you do, it would be natural in Schopenhauer's story to procreate. It would be anti-natural, therefore life-denying, to oppose those things. And the first problem that you might put forward is this. Why is affirmation good? Why choose it? What's so good about affirmation? Why am I bothered with it? And, you might think that if people get to a certain point where they don't feel like they're able to justify their normative claims, and there's a certain kind of end of the story, and that might be the case here. It might be just that we're supposed to think that it's obvious. Except that the arguments he uses against the opposing position also seem to apply to his own. So it's not just that he comes to rock-bottom ethical claims, that he seems to think that the problem with the other guy is not a problem for him. So let's just look back at what I call the central move, and let's just reinterpret it with affirmation. So we have the idea that the natural moralist claims that natural instincts and activities should be praised or valued, or says do the things that are natural, and that's what affirmation is, I'm claiming. And they therefore imply the value judgment about life, that life as a whole is good. Like that seems to be right. Now, assuming that those two moves are equivalent, so there's nothing right about the first version that's wrong about the second, assuming you can make that substitution without doing any harm to anything, looks like the frame of reference argument applies here too, because you're also making a claim about life as a whole, You're also in a position where you have no frame of reference. You don't have a frame of reference to make the judgment that life and all is good. So, you know, either there's something wrong with both of these positions, or there's nothing wrong with either of these positions, but I can't see a story where you've got something wrong with the first one. It's not also wrong with the second, at least as regards what I call the frame of reference problem. The life psychology problem looks much more promising here, I think. Because the whole point about the life psychology problem was that it's life operating through you to say that you don't like life. Or, in my analogy, it's the Foreign Office saying that, you know, Britain's interests should be thwarted. Right? There'd be nothing that odd about someone in the Foreign Office saying Britain's interests shouldn't be thwarted, and there's nothing odd about somebody saying that life as a whole is good. There's nothing odd about that. And, you know, when you talk about, when you look at the literature and when you think about the sorts of things that Nietzsche is associated with, you know, you can imagine him saying something like, it's healthier, or it's better, or it's more vigorous, or it's more flourishing, or some of the words which Nietzscheans seem to pick up on. But why be healthy in this sense? You might think that's an obvious question, because who would prefer to be unhealthy than to be healthy? Except when you ask or look at what Nietzsche thinks being healthy is, you begin to see that it might be something that you would legitimately not want to be. So, you know, here's how I think the thought's supposed to go. The thought's supposed to go, Victoria, just let me speak in kind of crude brushstrokes. So Victorian sexual morality was repressive. It wasn't nice to be told that certain things which were perfectly natural were unnatural. It was unpleasant. It was, repressive. Having a morality which tells you that natural things are perfectly natural and that you can do them as much as you want to, you know, that's going to be nicer for us, except that Nietzsche's hostile to the idea of niceness or comfort or ease as a guide for what's moral. Like, he often says that doing the natural thing is going to be difficult or unpleasant, or it's going to be bad to experience it. He also thinks that it's, incidentally, he also thinks it's natural, or it's in life's interest for certain people not to survive. So if I'm not one of his, and you know, this is late 19th century versions of eugenics that he's influenced by, and lots of kind of unpleasant things which Nietzsche scholars have a duty, it seems to me, not to ignore. The point being, it might turn out that it's in life's interests on his account for me not to survive or procreate or continue. And at one point he even talks about us having a mandate on life's behalf to ensure that certain people cannot reproduce. So, you know, we might look at that and think, wait, I actually don't really like life's views. Now, of course, you could imagine somebody criticising that on the basis that he's got life wrong. But let's just suppose he's not wrong about that. The point is, you know, the question, do I want to do what life does, is not just do I want to be healthy or not. It's much weirder than that, and it's got much more far-reaching conclusions. So, you know, keep that in mind. So that's the first problem. The first problem is, why should we do this? If we don't have an account of why we should do this, we're in trouble. The second problem is something slightly different. It's, how can we not do it? Recall that the whole point of the life psychology argument is that we already know that people who are saying that life as a whole is bad are life's agents. They're speaking on life's behalf. And that presupposes a story along the lines of life is in charge of my evaluation. That seems to be the premise of the whole discussion. So that seems to be Nietzsche's view. It certainly is Schopenhauer's view, except Schopenhauer has a story where there are very particular moments where that's not true. So most of the time in Schopenhauer, 99% of the time, you know, you're doing what the will for life arranges through you for you to do, but there are very particular moments when that power ceases to operate. So famously in aesthetic experience, for example, he thinks that's not happening. And in the case of rare ascetic individuals, so monk-like figures who deny the will, and deny that. So those people are not valuing in the way that life tells them to, and that's because their intellect is liberated from their will. Now, that caused Schopenhauer all sorts of problems, which Bertolt Brecht was writing, who's perfectly aware of, exactly when that happens, why that happens, the sort of metaphysics of it, if you like, but also kind of more basically, Schopenhauer seems to assume that all of our behaviour is will-operated, or life-directed, or life-run. Isn't it also more likely that this thing that looks like it isn't also is? I mean, if you believe that all these other things were life-operated, you probably think that this one was too. And that's effectively Nietzsche's point, right? This life-denial stuff might look like the will isn't working through you, but actually it is. So then it looks like what's going on is that all the time, whatever I'm doing, I'm affirming life by the definition that I've just set up. I mean, it might be that there are odd reasons why certain people are apparently claiming that life as a whole is bad, but whatever else, we know that they are affirming life the best they can. Now that seems to me to be very obviously not a view he wants to take. Life affirmation is supposed to be some kind of task, and whatever else Nietzsche thought, he seems to have thought that at least sections of contemporary society were not as affirmative as they could have been. That's a standard issue interpretative understanding of Nietzsche, which seems to me to be right. So, you know, if you want a label for that, label I'll give it is something like a wrong turn. Some of us have taken a wrong turn. Some of us are not affirming as much as we could have done. So it seems to me like a story which has us all affirming as best we possibly can all the time can't be right. It takes away the whole edge of his focus. His focus is we're not as affirmative as we could be. So that seems like that's wrong. That would be what would happen if you took kind of the view that life is always operating through us. To make us value what it wants to value. But of course, the moment that you take you put the brakes on slightly, the moment that you take life's control a little step back from us, and you say, okay, well, sure, it's usually choosing all our values, but it can't always be choosing all our values. Because it can't always be choosing all our values because, of course, some of us could be more affirmative than we seem to be. So the moment that you say it almost always, but not quite always, successfully values through us, then you've lost your life psychology argument. You've given up exactly what you wanted to have to make the argument that people into my life are strange. Because it could then be the case that they're just telling you what they happen to think. Much in the same way that for Schopenhauer, the aesthetic or the person having artistic experience isn't just the world's mouthpiece. They've got critical intellectual independence from what the world's telling them to do. So, you know, to continue the kind of hackneyed analogy, you know, you've got a Foreign Office official on television telling you that British interests should be thwarted, but you don't know whether they're doing it in their official capacity or whether they're kind of having a day off. If they're telling you their own views, there's nothing weird about what's going on. I mean, you might wonder why. You know, there are other questions, but there's nothing. It's not that the Foreign Office has made the decision to tell its people to tell. It's just that somebody has decided to give you their own view. And so once you've got that, you have no objection to you have no right to assume that somebody who's claiming that life as a whole is bad is doing anything other than giving their own independent set of values. So that's that. Okay, so just to conclude on the subplot that I've been sketching out very quickly, what I said in section four very briefly was, I think that the link he's trying to draw between what I've called natural affirmation, so this affirmation story, and what I've called total affirmation, which is the idea that you should affirm absolutely everything that happens in the world, that link, which you can make if you have something like a story where life operates through everything to make everything happen as it wants to, and therefore affirming life just as affirming the whole lot, that link is precisely what gets lost at the end there, because the moment that you stop saying, well, life controls everything that happens, then you can't move from natural to total affirmation. And if you can move from natural to total affirmation, right, then you're sort of thrust back onto the problem of, well, if everything is life determined, then we're all maximally affirming and there's no wrong turn. So effectively, the link that he wants to set up there in this protective evidence, I think that it does, that flounders on exactly the same grounds that the natural affirmation stuff flounders on too. That's that. Okay, so what, I mean, for that, that's the end of the story, and I'll stop very shortly. But I just wanted to say a word about what for anybody interested in Nietzsche more generally, what this might mean overall. The readings of genealogy often flip between Nietzsche's account of history is kind of internal criticism, where he's to say, look, this is the history of morality, and this is just what it's like, and you can see by looking at it without any bringing any value judgment of your own, you can just tell internally it has this set of problems, and it will eventually come undone by its own standards. And then some people think that he's bringing in with him a set of external claims or evaluations, and he's using them to criticize morality. It seems to me that this story explains at least why he wouldn't have necessarily seen the difference between those two things. If you've got a story about what's natural, and you think that what's natural operates through us, more or less in the way that I've described, then it just is the case that there is an internal contradiction within Christian morality, because Christian morality is this, via the life psychology argument, is this internally contradictory thing. So, you know, he is bringing in extra ideas, but what those extra ideas bring in with him is a story about how this contradicts, the story contradicts itself. So, you know, if you're asking me which side of this debate I fall on, it's got to be he's bringing in values with him. But what I'm really saying is, you can see why somebody with those values and putting them in wouldn't really see a major difference between an internal criticism and an external. But that's just one way in which thinking about this might start to change the way that we think about Nietzsche's late work. Okay, I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much for listening.